Chapter 17. The Unaccountable Appearance of 25 Guineas. January 1808. The best grocer in town is Brandy's in St. James's Street. I'm not alone in that opinion. Sir Walter Pole's grandfather, Sir William Pole, declined to purchase coffee, chocolate, or tea from any other establishment, declaring that in comparison with Mr. Brandy's superfine high-roasted turkey coffee, all other coffees had a mealy flavour. It must be said, however, that Sir William Pole's patronage was a somewhat mixed blessing. Though liberal in his praise, and always courteous and condescending to the shop people, he was scarcely ever known to pay a bill, and when he died, the amount of money owing to Brandy's was considerable. Mr. Brandy, a short-tempered, pinch-faced, cross little old man, was beside himself with rage about it. He died shortly afterwards, and was presumed by many people to have done so on purpose, and to have gone in pursuit of his noble debtor. At Mr. Brandy's death, the business came into the possession of his widow. Mr. Brandy had married rather late in life, and my readers will not be much surprised, I dare say, to learn that Mrs. Brandy had not been entirely happy in her marriage. She had quickly discovered that Mr. Brandy loved to look at guineas and shillings more than he ever loved to look at her. And though I say it must have been a strange sort of man that did not love to look at her, for she was everything that was delightful and amiable, all soft brown curls, light blue eyes, and a sweet expression. It would seem to me that an old man such as Mr. Brandy, with nothing to recommend him but his money, ought to have treasured a young, pretty wife, and studied hard to please her in everything he could. But he did not. He had even denied her a house of her own to live in, which was something he could have afforded very easily. So loath had he been to part with a sixpence that he declared they should live in the little room above the shop in St. James's Street. And for the 12 years of her marriage, this apartment served Mrs. Brandy as parlour, bedroom, dining parlour, and kitchen. But Mr. Brandy had not been dead 3 weeks when she bought a house in Islington near the Angel and acquired 3 maids whose names were Suki, Daphne, and Delphina. She also employed 2 men to attend the customers in the shop. John Upchurch was a steady soul, hard-working and capable. Toby Smith was a red-haired, nervous man whose behaviour often puzzled Mrs. Brandy. Sometimes he would be silent and unhappy, and at other times he would be suddenly cheerful and full of unexpected confidences. From certain discrepancies in the accounts, such as may occur in any business, and from the circumstances of Toby looking miserable and ill at ease whenever she questioned him about it, Mrs. Brandy had begun to fear that he might be pocketing the difference. One January evening, her dilemma took a strange turn. She was sitting in her little parlour above the shop when there was a knock upon the door, and Toby Smith came shuffling in, quite unable to meet her eye.
"What's the matter, Toby?"
"If you please, ma'am," said Toby, looking this way and that, "the money won't come right. John and me have counted it out again and again, ma'am, and cast up the sums 12 times or more, but we cannot make head or tail of it."
Mrs. Brandy tutted and sighed, and asked by how much they were out.
25 guineas, ma'am."
25 guineas? Cried Mrs. Brandy in horror. 25 guineas? How could we possibly have lost so much? Oh, I hope you are mistaken, Toby. 25 guineas? I would not have supposed there to be so much money in the shop. Oh, Toby, she cried, as another thought struck her. We must have been robbed.
No, ma'am, said Toby. Beg your pardon, ma'am, but you mistake. I did not mean to say we are 25 guineas short. We are over, ma'am, by that amount.
Mrs. Brandy stared at him.
Which you may see for yourself, ma'am, said Toby, if you will just come down to the shop.
He held the door open for her with an anxious, pleading expression upon his face. So Mrs. Brandy ran downstairs into the shop, and Toby followed after her. It was about 9 o'clock on a moonless night. The shutters were all put up, and John and Toby had extinguished the lamps. The shop ought to have been as dark as the inside of a tea caddy, but instead, it was filled with a soft, golden light, which appeared to emanate from something golden which lay upon the countertop. A heap of shining guineas was lying there. Mrs. Brandy picked up one of the coins and examined it. It was as if she held a ball of soft yellow light with a coin at the bottom of it. The light was odd. It made Mrs. Brandy, John, and Toby look quite unlike themselves. Mrs. Brandy appeared proud and haughty,
John looked sly and deceitful, and Toby wore an expression of great ferocity. Needless to say, all of these were qualities quite foreign to their characters. But stranger still was the transformation that the light worked upon the dozens of small mahogany drawers that formed one wall of the shop. Upon other evenings, the gilt lettering upon the drawers proclaimed the contents to be such things as mace, blades, mustard, unhusked, nutmegs, ground fennel, bay leaves, pepper of Jamaica, essence of ginger, caraway, peppercorns, and vinegar, and all the other stock of a fashionable and prosperous grocery business. But now, the words appeared to read, mercy deserved, mercy undeserved, nightmares, good fortune, bad fortune, persecution by families, ingratitude of children, confusion, perspicacity, and veracity. It was as well that none of them noticed this odd change. Mrs. Brandy would have been most distressed by it had she known. She would not have had the least notion what to charge for these new commodities.
Well, said Mrs. Brandy, they must have come from somewhere. Has anyone sent today to pay their bill?
John shook his head. So did Toby.
And besides, added Toby, no one owes so much, excepting, of course, the Duchess of Wurtsop. And frankly, ma'am, in that case... Yes, Toby, that will do, interrupted Mrs. Brandy. She thought for a moment. Perhaps, she said, some gentleman, wishing to wipe the rain from his face, pulled out his handkerchief and so caused the money to tumble out of his pocket onto the floor.
But we did not find it upon the floor, said John. It was here, in the cash box with all the rest.
Well, said Mrs. Brandy, I do not know what to say. Did anyone pay with a guinea today?
No, said Toby and John. No one had paid today with a guinea, let alone 25 such guineas, or 25 such persons.
And such yellow guineas, ma'am, remarked John. Each one the very twin of all the others, without a spot of tarnish upon any of them.
Should I run and fetch Mr. Black, ma'am? Asked Toby.
Oh, yes, said Mrs. Brandy eagerly.
But then again, perhaps no. We ought not to trouble Mr. Black, unless there's anything very wrong. And nothing is wrong, is it, Toby? Or perhaps it is. I cannot tell.
The sudden and unaccountable arrival of large sums of money is such a very rare thing in our modern age that neither Toby nor John was able to help their mistress decide whether it were a wrong thing or a right.
But then, continued Mrs. Brandy, Mr. Black is so clever. I dare say he will understand this puzzle in an instant. Go to Harley Street, Toby. Present my compliments to Mr. Black, and say that if he is at liberty, I shall be glad of a few moments' conversation with him. No, wait. Do not say that. It sounds so presumptuous. You must apologize for disturbing him, and say that whenever he should happen to be at liberty, I should be grateful. Grateful. I should be grateful for a few moments' conversation with him.
Mrs. Brander's acquaintance with Stephen Black had begun when Sir Walter had inherited his grandfather's debts, and Mrs. Brandy had inherited her husband's business. Every week or so, Stephen had come with a guinea or two to help pay off the debt. Yet curiously, Mrs. Brandy was often reluctant to accept the money.
Oh, Mr. Black, she would say, pray put the money away again. I'm certain that Sir Walter has greater need of it than I. We did such excellent business last week. We've got some Caraca chocolate in the shop just at present, which people have been kind enough to say is the best to be had anywhere in London, infinitely superior to other chocolate in both flavour and texture, and they've been sending for it all over town. Will you not take a cup, Mr. Black?
Then Mrs. Brandy would bring the chocolate in a pretty blue and white china chocolate pot, and pour Stephen a cup, and anxiously inquire how he liked it. For it seemed that even though people had been sending for it from all over town, Mrs. Brandy could not feel quite convinced of its virtues until she knew Stephen's opinion. Nor did her care of him end with making him chocolate. She was solicitous for his health. If it happened to be a cold day, she would be concerned that he was not warm enough. If it were raining, she would worry that he might catch a cold. If it were a hot, dry day, she would insist that he sit by a window overlooking a little green garden to refresh himself. When it was time for him to go, she would revive the question of the guineas.
But as to next week, Mr. Black, I cannot say. Next week I may need a guinea very badly. People do not always pay their bills, and so I will be so bold as to ask you to bring it again on Wednesday. Wednesday at about 3 o'clock. I shall be quite disengaged at 3 o'clock, and I shall be sure to have a pot of chocolate ready, as you are so kind as to say you like it very much.
The gentlemen among my readers will smile to themselves and say that women never did understand business. But the ladies may agree with me that Mrs. Brandy understood her business very well, for the chief business of Mrs. Brandy's life was to make Stephen Black as much in love with her as she was with him. In due course, Toby returned, not with a message from Stephen Black, but with Stephen himself, and Mrs. Brandy's anxiety about the coins was swept away by a new and altogether more pleasant agitation.
"Oh, Mr. Black, we did not expect to see you so soon. I did not imagine you would be at liberty."
Stephen stood in the darkness outside the radiance cast by the strange coins. "It does not matter where I am tonight," he said in a dull tone, quite unlike his usual voice. "The house is all at sixes and sevens. Her ladyship is not well." Mrs. Brandy, John, and Toby were shocked to hear this. Like every other citizen of London, they took a close interest in everything that concerned her ladyship. They prided themselves upon her connection with all sorts of aristocratic persons, but it was the patronage of Lady Pole which gave them the greatest satisfaction. Nothing pleased them so much as being able to assure people that when Lady Pole sat down to breakfast, her ladyship's roll was spread with Mrs. Brandy's preserves, and her coffee cup was filled with coffee made with Mrs. Brandy's beans. Mrs. Brandy was suddenly struck with a most unpleasant idea.
"I hope her ladyship did not eat something which disagreed with her," she asked.
"No," said Stephen with a sigh. "It is nothing of that sort. She complains of aches in all her limbs, odd dreams, and feeling cold. But mostly she is silent and out of spirits. Her skin is icy to the touch."
Stephen stepped into the queer light. The strange alterations which it had made to the appearances of Toby, John, and Mrs. Brandy were nothing to the changes it worked upon Stephen. His native handsomeness increased 5, 7, 10-fold. He acquired an expression of almost supernatural nobility, and most extraordinary of all, the light somehow seemed to concentrate in a band around his brow, so that he appeared to have been crowned with a diadem. Yet, just as before, none of those present noticed anything out of the common. He turned the coins over in his thin black fingers.
"Where were they, John?"
"Here in the cash box, with all the rest of the money. Where in the world can they have come from, Mr. Black?"
"I am as puzzled as you are. I have no explanation to offer." Stephen turned to Mrs. Brandy. "My chief concern, ma'am, is that you should protect yourself from any suspicion that you have come by the money dishonestly. I think you must give the money to a lawyer. Instruct him to advertise in the Times and the Morning Chronicle to discover if anyone lost 25 guineas in Mrs. Brandy's shop."
"A lawyer, Mr. Black?" cried Mrs. Brandy, horrified. "Oh, but that will cost a world of money."
"Lawyers always do, ma'am."
At that moment, a gentleman in St. James's Street passed Mrs. Brandy's shop, and discerning a golden radiance shining out of the chinks in the shutters, realized that someone was within. He happened to be in need of tea and sugar, and so he knocked upon the door.
"Customer, Toby," cried Mrs. Brandy.
Toby hurried to open the door, and John put the money away. The instant that he closed the lid of the cash box, the room became dark, and for the first time, they realized that they'd been seeing each other by the light of the eerie coins. So John ran around, relighting the lamps and making the place look cheerful, and Toby weighed out the things which the customer wanted. Stephen Black sank into a chair and passed his hand across his forehead. He looked grey-faced and tired to death. Mrs. Brandy sat down in the chair next to his and touched his hand very gently.
"You are not well, my dear Mr. Black."
"It's just that I ache all over, as a man does who has been dancing all night."
He sighed again and rested his head upon his hand. Mrs. Brandy withdrew her hand.
"I did not know there was a ball last night," she said.
There was a tinge of jealousy to her words.
"I hope you had a most delightful time. Who were your partners?"
No, there was no ball. I seemed to have all the pains of dancing without having had any of the pleasure."
He raised his head suddenly. "Do you hear that?" he asked.
"What, Mr. Black?"
"That bell, tolling for the dead.
She listened for a moment.
No, I do not hear anything. I hope you will stay to supper, my dear Mr. Black. It would do us so much honour. I fear it will not be a very elegant meal. There is very little, hardly anything at all. Just some steamed oysters and a pigeon pie and a haricot of mutton. But an old friend like you will make allowances, I'm sure. Herr Toby can fetch them.
Are you certain you do not hear it?
No.
I cannot stay. He looked as if he meant to say something more. Indeed, he opened his mouth to say it, but the bell seemed to intrude itself upon his attention again, and he was silent. Good evening to you. He rose, and with a rapid half-bow, he walked out. In St. James's Street, the bell continued to toll. He walked like a man in a fog. He had just reached Piccadilly when an apron porter carrying a basket full of fish came very suddenly out of a little alleyway. In trying to get out of the porter's way, Stephen collided with a stout gentleman in a blue coat and a Bedford hat who was standing on the corner of Albemarle Street. The stout gentleman turned and saw Stephen. Instantly, he was all alarm. He saw a black face close to his own face and black hands near his pockets and valuables. He paid no attention to Stephen's expensive clothes and respectable air, but immediately concluding that he was about to be robbed or knocked down, he raised his umbrella to strike a blow in his own defense. It was the moment that Stephen had dreaded all his life. He supposed that constables would be called, and he would be dragged before the magistrates, and it was probable that even the patronage and friendship of Sir Walter Pole would not save him. Would an English jury be able to conceive of a black man who did not steal and lie? A black man who was a respectable person? It did not seem very likely. Yet now that his fate had come upon him, Stephen found he did not care very much about it, and he watched events unfold as though he were watching a play through thick glass or a scene at the bottom of a pond. The stout gentleman opened his eyes wide in fright, anger, and indignation. He opened his mouth wide to begin accusing Stephen, but in that moment he began to change. His body became the trunk of a tree. He suddenly sprouted arms in all directions, and all the arms became branches. His face became a bowl, and he shot up 20 feet. Where his hat and umbrella had been, there was a thick crown of ivy. An oak tree in Piccadilly, thought Stephen, not much interested. That is unusual. Piccadilly was changing too. A carriage happened to be passing. It clearly belonged to someone of importance, for as well as the coachman upon his box, two footmen rode behind. There was a coat of arms upon the door, and it was drawn by four matched greys. As Stephen watched, the horses grew taller and thinner until they seemed about to disappear entirely, and at that point they were suddenly transformed into a grove of delicate silver birches. The carriage became a holly bush, and the coachman and the footman became an owl and two nightingales, which promptly flew away. A lady and gentleman walking along together suddenly sprouted twigs in every direction and became an elder bush. A dog became a shaggy clump of dry bracken. The gas lamps that hung above the street were sucked up into the sky and became stars in a fretwork of winter trees, and Piccadilly itself dwindled to a barely discernible path through a dark winter wood. But just as in a dream, where the most extraordinary events arrive complete with their own explanation and become reasonable in an instant, Stephen found nothing to be surprised at. Rather, it seemed to him that he had always known that Piccadilly stood in close proximity to a magical wood. He began to walk along the path. The wood was very dark and quiet. Above his head, the stars were the brightest he had ever seen, and the trees were nothing more than black shapes, mere absences of stars. The thick, grey misery and stupidity which had enveloped his mind and spirit all day disappeared, and he began to muse upon the curious dream he had the night before about meeting a strange green-coated person with thistle-down hair, who had taken him to a house where he had danced all night with the queerest people. The sad bell sounded much clearer in the wood than it had in London, and Stephen followed the sound along the path. In a very short while, he came to an immense stone house with 1,000 windows. A feeble light shone out of some of these openings. A high wall surrounded the house. Stephen passed through, though he did not quite understand how, for he saw no sign of a gate, and found himself in a wide and dreary courtyard, where skulls, broken bones, and rusting weapons were scattered about as if they had lain there for centuries. Despite the size and grandeur of the house, Its only entrance was a mean little door, and Stephen had to bend low to pass through. Immediately, he beheld a vast crowd of people, all dressed in the finest clothes. Two gentlemen stood just inside the door. They wore fine dark coats, spotless white stockings and gloves and dancing pumps. They were talking together, but the moment Stephen appeared, one turned and smiled. "Ah, Stephen Black," he said. "We've been waiting for you." At that moment, the viol and pipe started up again.
Chapter 18. Sir Walter consults gentlemen in several professions. February 1808. Lady Pole sat by the window, pale and unsmiling. She said very little, and whenever she did say anything, her remarks were odd and not at all to the point. When her husband and friends anxiously inquired what the matter was, she replied that she was sick of dancing and wished to dance no more. As for music, it was the most detestable thing in the world. She wondered that she had never realized it before. Sir Walter regarded this lapse into silence and indifference as highly alarming. It was altogether too like the illness which had caused her ladyship so much suffering before her marriage and ended so tragically in her early death. Had she not been pale before? Well, she was pale now. Had she not been cold before? She was so again. During her ladyship's previous illness, no doctor had ever attended her, and naturally doctors everywhere resented this as an insult to their profession. "Oh," they cried, whenever Lady Pole's name was mentioned. "The magic which brought her back to life was no doubt very wonderful, but if only the proper medicines had been administered in time, then there would have been no need for the magic in the first place." Mr. Lascelles had been right when he declared the fault to be entirely Mrs. Wintertown's. She detested doctors, and had never allowed one to come near her daughter. Sir Walter, however, was hindered by no such prejudice. He immediately sent for Mr. Bailey. Mr. Bailey was a Scottish gentleman, who had long been considered the foremost practitioner of his profession in London. He had written a great many books with important-sounding titles, and he was physician extraordinary to the king. He had a sensible face and carried a gold-top stick as a symbol of his preeminence. He answered Sir Walter's summons swiftly, eager to prove the superiority of medicine to magic. The examination done, he came out again. Her ladyship was in excellent health, he said. She had not got so much as a cold. Sir Walter explained again how different she was today from what she had been only a few days ago. Mr. Bailey regarded Sir Walter thoughtfully. He said he believed he understood the problem. Sir Walter and her ladyship had not been married long, had they? Well, Sir Walter must forgive him, but doctors were often obliged to say things which other people would not. Sir Walter was not accustomed to married life. He would soon discover that married people often quarrelled. There was nothing to be ashamed of. Even the most devoted couples disagreed sometimes, and when they did, it was not uncommon for one partner to pretend an indisposition. Nor was it always the lady that did so. Was there perhaps something that Lady Pole had set her heart upon? Well, if it were a small thing like a new gown or a bonnet, why not let her have it, since she wanted it so much? If it were a large thing like a house or a visit to Scotland, then perhaps it would be best to talk to her about it. Mr. Bailey was sure that her ladyship was not an unreasonable person. There was a pause, during which Sir Walter stared at Mr. Bailey down his long nose. "Her ladyship and I have not quarrelled," he said at last. "Ah," said Mr. Bailey, in a kindly fashion. It might well appear to Sir Walter that there had been no quarrel. It was often the case that gentlemen did not observe the signs. Mr. Bailey advised Sir Walter to think carefully. Might he have not said something to vex her ladyship? Mr. Bailey did not speak of blame. It was all part of the little accommodations that married people must make in beginning their life together.
"But it is not Lady Pole's character to behave like a spoiled child."
"No doubt, no doubt," said Mr. Bailey. "But her ladyship was very young, and young persons ought always be permitted some license for folly. Old heads did not sit upon young shoulders. Sir Walter ought not to expect it." Mr. Bailey was rather warming to his subject. He had examples to hand, drawn from history and literature, of sober-minded, clever men and women who had all done foolish things in their youth. However, a glance at Sir Walter's face persuaded him that he should press the point no further. Sir Walter was in a similar situation. He, too, had several things to say, and a great mind to say some of them, but he felt himself on uncertain ground. A man who marries for the first time, at the age of 42, knows only too well that almost all his acquaintance are better qualified to manage his domestic affairs than him. So Sir Walter contented himself with frowning at Mr. Bailey. And then, since it was almost 11 o'clock, he called for his carriage and his secretary and drove to Burlington House, where he had an appointment to meet the other ministers. At Burlington House, he walked through pillared courtyards and gilded anterooms. He mounted great marble staircases that were overhung by painted ceilings, in which impossible numbers of painted gods, goddesses, heroes, and nymphs tumbled out of blue skies or reclined on fluffy white clouds. He was bowed at by a whole host of powdered, liveried footmen, until he came to the room where the ministers were looking at papers and arguing with one another. "But why do you not send for Mr. Norrell, Sir Walter?" asked Mr. Canning, the moment he heard what the matter was. "I am astonished that you have not already done so. I am sure that her ladyship's indisposition will prove to be nothing more than some slight irregularity in the magic which brought her back to life. Mr. Norrell can make some small adjustment to a spell, and her ladyship will be well again."
"Oh, quite," agreed Lord Castlereagh. "It seems to me that Lady Pole has gone beyond physicians. You and I, Sir Walter, are sent upon this earth by the grace of God, but her ladyship is here by the grace of Mr. Norrell. Her hold upon life is different from the rest of us, theologically, and, I dare say, medically as well."
"Whenever Mrs. Percival is unwell," interjected Mr. Percival, a small, precise lawyer of unremarkable aspect and manners, who held the exalted position of Chancellor of the Exchequer, "the first person I apply to is her maid. After all, who knows a lady's state of health better than her maid? What does Lady Pole's maid say?"
Sir Walter shook his head.
"Bamperson is as mystified as I am. She agreed with me that her ladyship was in excellent health 2 days ago, and now she's cold, pale, listless, and unhappy. This is the beginning and end of Pampersford's information. That and a great deal of nonsense about the house being haunted. I do not know what is the matter with the servants just now. They are all in an odd, nervous condition. One of the footmen came to me this morning with a tale of meeting someone upon the stairs at midnight, a person with a green coat and a great quantity of pale, silvery hair."
"What, a ghost? An apparition?" asked Lord Hawkesbury.
"I believe that is what he meant, yes."
"How very extraordinary. Did it speak?" asked Mr. Canning.
"No. Geoffrey said it gave him a cold, disdainful look and passed on."
"Oh, your footman was dreaming, Sir Walter. He was certainly dreaming," said Mr. Percival.
"Or drunk," offered Mr. Canning.
"Yes, that occurred to me too, so naturally I asked Stephen Black," said Sir Walter. "But Stephen is as foolish as the rest of them. I can scarcely get him to speak to me."
"Well," said Mr. Canning, "you will not, I think, attempt to deny that there is something here that suggests magic, and is it not Mr. Norrell's business to explain what other people cannot? Send for Mr. Norrell, Sir Walter." This was so reasonable that Sir Walter began to wonder why he had not thought of it himself. He had the highest opinion of his own abilities, and did not think he would generally miss so obvious a connection. The truth was, he realized that he did not really like magic. He had never liked it, not at the beginning when he had supposed it to be false, and not now that it had proved to be real. But he could hardly explain this to the other ministers, he who had persuaded them to employ a magician for the first time in 200 years. At 3:30, he returned to Harley Street. It was the eeriest part of a winter day. Twilight was turning all the buildings and people to blurred black nothingnesses, while above, the sky remained a dizzying silver blue and was full of cold light. A winter sunset was painting a swathe of rose colour and blood colour at the end of all the streets, pleasing to the eyes, but somehow chilling to the heart. As Sir Walter gazed from his carriage window, he thought it fortunate that he was not in any way a fanciful person. Someone else might have been quite unsettled by the combination of the disagreeable task of consulting a magician and this queer, black and bloody dissolution of the London streets. Geoffrey opened the door of No. 9 Harley Street, and Sir Walter rapidly mounted the stairs. On the first floor, he passed the Venetian drawing-room where her ladyship had been sitting that morning. A sort of presentiment made him look inside. At first, it did not seem as though anybody could be there. The fire was low in the grate, creating a sort of second twilight within the room. Nobody had lit a lamp or candle yet. And then he saw her. She was sitting very upright in a chair by the window. Her back was towards him. Everything about her, chair, posture, even the folds of her gown and shawl, was precisely the same as when he had left her that morning. The moment he reached his study, he sat down and wrote an urgent message to Mr. Norrell. Mr. Norrell did not come immediately. An hour or two passed. At last, he arrived with an expression of fixed calm upon his face. Sir Walter met him in the hall and described what had happened. He then proposed that they go upstairs to the Venetian drawing-room.
"Oh," said Mr. Norrell quickly. "From what you tell me, Sir Walter, I am quite certain there is no need to trouble Lady Pole, because, you see, I fear I can do nothing for her. Much as it pains me to say this to you, my dear Sir Walter, for, as you know, I should always wish to serve you when I can, but whatever it is that has distressed her ladyship, I do not believe that it is in the power of magic to remedy."
Sir Walter sighed. He ran his hand through his hair and looked unhappy.
"Mr. Bailey found nothing wrong, and so I thought,
oh, but it is precisely that circumstance which makes me so certain that I cannot help you. Magic and medicine are not always so distinct from one another as you seem to imagine. Their spheres often overlap. An illness may have both a medical cure and a magical one. If her ladyship were truly ill, or if, God forbid, she were to die again, then certainly there is magic to cure or restore her. But forgive me, Sir Walter, what you have described seems more a spiritual ailment than a physical one, and as such belongs neither to magic nor medicine. I'm no expert in these matters, but perhaps a clergyman might be found to answer better."
"But Lord Castlereagh thought, I do not know if it's true, Lord Castlereagh thought that since Lady Pole owes her life to magic, I confess that I did not understand him very well, but I believe he meant to say that since her ladyship's life is founded upon magic, she would only be susceptible to cure by magic."
"Indeed, Lord Castlereagh said that. Oh, he's quite mistaken. But I'm most intrigued that he should have thought of it. That is what used to be called the Merodian heresy."
Footnote 1. This theory was first expounded by a Cornish magician called Merod in the 12th century, and there were many variants. In its most extreme form, it involves the belief that any man who has been cured, saved, or raised to life by magic is no longer subject to God and his church, though they may owe all sorts of allegiance to the magician or fairy who has helped them. Merod was arrested and brought before Stephen, King of Southern England, and his bishops at a council in Winchester. Merod was branded, beaten, and stripped half-naked. Then he was cast out. The bishops ordered that no one should help him. Merod tried to walk from Winchester to Newcastle, where the Raven King's castle was. He died on the way. The Northern English belief that certain sorts of murderers belong not to God or to the devil, but to the Raven King, is another form of the Merodian heresy.
"The 12th century abbot of Rivaulx dedicated himself to its destruction and was later made a saint. Of course, the theology of magic has never been a favourite subject of mine, but I believe I am correct in saying that in the 69th chapter of William Pantler's Three Perfectible States of Being..."
Footnote 2. Three Perfectible States of Being by William Pantler, published Henry Linnet, London, 1735. The three perfectible beings are angels, men, and fairies. Mr. Norrell seemed about to embark upon one of his long, dull speeches upon the history of English magic, full of references to books no one had ever heard of. Sir Walter interrupted him with,
Yes, but do you have any notion who the person with the green coat and the silver hair might be?"
"Oh," said Mr. Norrell. "You think there was somebody then? But that seems to me most unlikely. Might it not be something more in the nature of a dressing gown left hanging on a hook by a negligent servant, just where one does not expect to see it? I myself have often been badly startled by this wig which you see now upon my head. Lucas ought to put it away each night. He knows he ought. But several times now he has left it on its wig stand on the mantelpiece, where it is reflected in the mirror above the fireplace, and resembles nothing so much in the world as two gentlemen with their heads together, whispering about me.
Mr. Norrell blinked his small eyes rapidly at Sir Walter. Then, having declared that he could do nothing, he wished Sir Walter good evening and left the house. Mr. Norrell went straight home. As soon as he arrived at his house in Hanover Square, he immediately went up to a little study upon the second floor. This was a quiet room at the back of the house, overlooking the garden. The servants never entered when he was working in this room, and even Childermas needed some unusually pressing reason to disturb him there. Though Mr. Norrell rarely gave warning of when he intended to use this little study, it was one of the rules of the household that it was always kept in readiness for him. Just now a fire was burning brightly in the grate, and all the lamps were lit. But someone had neglected to draw the curtains, and consequently the window had become a black mirror in which the room was reflected. Mr. Norrell sat down at the desk which faced the window. He opened a large volume, one of many upon the desk, and began to murmur a spell to himself. A coal falling from the grate, a shadow moving in the room, caused him to look up. He saw his own alarmed reflection in the dark window, and he saw someone standing behind him. A pale, silvery face with a mass of shining hair around it. Mr. Norrell did not turn, but instead addressed the reflection in the window in a bitter, angry tone.
When you said that you would take half the young lady's life, I thought you would permit her to remain with her friends and family for 75 years. I thought it would appear as if she'd simply died.
I never said so.
You cheated me. You have not helped me at all. You risk undoing everything by your tricks, cried Mr. Norrell.
The person in the window made a sound of disapproval.
I had hoped that I would find you more reasonable at our second meeting. Instead, you are full of arrogance and unreasonable anger against me. I have kept to the terms of our agreement. I have done what you asked and taken nothing that was not mine to take. If you were truly concerned for the happiness of Lady Pole, you would rejoice that she is now placed among friends who truly admire and esteem her.
Oh, as to that, said Mr. Norrell scornfully, I do not care one way or the other. What is the fate of one young woman compared to the success of English magic? No, it is her husband that concerns me, the man for whom I did all this. He is brought quite low by your treachery. Supposing he should not recover, supposing he were to resign from government, I might never find another ally so willing to help me.
Footnote 3. It is clear from this remark that Mr. Norrell did not yet comprehend how highly the ministers in general regarded him, or how eager they were to make use of him in the war.
I shall certainly never again have a minister so much in my debt.
Her husband, is it? Well then, I shall raise him up to some lofty position. I shall make him much greater than anything he could achieve by his own efforts. He shall be Prime Minister, or Emperor of Great Britain, perhaps. Will that suit you?
No, no, cried Mr. Norrell. You do not understand. I merely want him to be pleased with me and to talk to the other ministers and to persuade them of the great good that my magic can do the country.
It is entirely mysterious to me, declared the person in the window haughtily, why you should prefer the help of this person to mine. What does he know of magic? Nothing. I can teach you to raise up mountains and crush your enemies beneath them. I can make the clouds sing at your approach. I can make it spring when you arrive and winter when you leave. I can... Oh, yes. And all you want in return is to shackle English magic to your whim. You will steal Englishmen and women away from their homes and make England a place fit only for your degenerate race. The price of your help is too high for me.
The person in the window did not reply directly to these accusations. Instead, a candlestick suddenly leapt from its place on the little table and flew across the room, shattering a mirror on the opposite wall and a little china bust of Thomas Lanchester. Then all was quiet. Mr. Norrell sat in a state of fright and trembling. He looked down at the books spread out upon his desk, but if he read, then it was in a fashion known only to magicians, for his eye did not travel over the page. After an interval of several minutes, he looked up again. The person reflected in the window was gone. Everyone's plans concerning Lady Pole came to nothing. The marriage, which for a few short weeks had seemed to promise so much to both partners, lapsed into indifference and silence upon her part, and into anxiety and misery upon his. Far from becoming a leader of the fashionable world, she declined to go anywhere. No one visited her, and the fashionable world very soon forgot her. The servants at Harley Street grew reluctant to enter the room where she sat, though none of them could have said why. The truth was that there hung about her the faintest echo of a bell. A chill wind seemed to blow upon her from far away and caused anyone who came near her to shiver. So she sat, hour after hour, wrapped in her shawl, neither moving nor speaking, and bad dreams and shadows gathered about her. Chapter 19. The Peepo Day Boys. February 1808. Curiously, no one noticed that the strange malady that afflicted her ladyship was to a precision the same as that which afflicted Stephen Black. He, too, complained of feeling tired and cold, and on the rare occasions that either of them said anything, they both spoke in a low, exhausted manner. But perhaps it was not so curious. The different styles of life of a lady and a butler tend to obscure any similarities in their situations. A butler has his work and must do it. Unlike Lady Pole, Stephen was not suffered to sit idly by a window hour after hour without speaking. Symptoms that were raised to the dignity of an illness in Lady Pole were dismissed as mere low spirits in Stephen. John Longridge, the cook at Harley Street, had suffered from low spirits for more than 30 years, and he was quick to welcome Stephen as a newcomer to the Freemasonry of melancholy. He seemed glad, poor fellow, of a companion in woe. In the evenings, when Stephen would sit at the kitchen table, with his head buried in his hands, John Longridge would come and sit down on the other side of the table and begin commiserating with him.
"I condole with you, sir. Indeed I do. Low spirits, Mr. Black, are the very worst torment that a man can be afflicted with. Sometimes it seems to me that all of London resembles nothing so much as cold peas porridge, both in colour and consistency. I see people with cold peas porridge faces and cold peas porridge hands walking down cold peas porridge streets. Ah, me, how bad I feel then. The very sun up in the sky is cold and grey and porridgey, and has no power to warm me. Do you often feel chilled, sir?"
John Longridge would lay his hand upon Stephen's hand.
"Ah, Mr. Black, sir," he would say, "you're as cold as the tomb."
Stephen felt he was like a person sleepwalking. He did not live any more. He only dreamed. He dreamed of the house in Harley Street and of the other servants. He dreamed of his work and his friends and of Mrs. Brandy. Sometimes he dreamed of things that were very strange, things that he knew in some small, chilly, far-off part of himself ought not to be. He might be walking along a hallway or up the stairs in the house in Harley Street, and he would turn and see other hallways and staircases leading off into the distance, hallways and staircases which did not belong there. It would be as if the house in Harley Street had accidentally got lodged inside a much larger and more ancient edifice. The passageways would be stone-vaulted and full of dust and shadows. The stairs and floors would be so worn and uneven that they would more resemble stones found in nature than architecture. But the strangest thing of all about these ghostly halls was that they would be quite familiar to Stephen. He did not understand why or how, but he would catch himself thinking, "Yes, just beyond that corner is the Eastern Armory," or, "Those stairs lead to the Disembowler's Tower." Whenever he saw these passageways, or, as he sometimes did, sensed their presence without actually perceiving them, then he would feel a little more lively, a little more like his old self. Whatever part of him it was that had frozen up, his soul, his heart, unfroze itself the merest hair's breadth, and thought, curiosity, and feeling began to pulse again within him. But for the rest, nothing amused him, nothing satisfied him. All were shadows, emptiness, echoes, and dust. Sometimes his restless spirit would cause him to go on long, solitary wanders through the dark winter streets around Mayfair and Piccadilly. On one such evening in late February, he found himself outside Mr. Wharton's coffee house in Oxford Street. It was a place he knew well. The upper room was home to the Peepo Day Boys, a club for the grander sort of male servants in London's grand houses. Lord Castlereagh's valet was a notable member. The Duke of Portland's coachman was another, and so was Stephen. The Pipo Day boys met upon the third Tuesday of every month, and enjoyed the same pleasures as the members of any other London club. They drank and ate, gambled, talked politics, and gossiped about their mistresses. On other evenings of the month, it was the habit of Pipo Day boys, who happened to find themselves disengaged, to repair to the upper room of Mr. Wharton's coffee house, there to refresh their spirits with the society of their fellows. Stephen went inside and mounted the stairs to the upper room. This apartment was much like the corresponding part of any similar establishment in the city. It was as full of tobacco smoke as such resorts of the masculine half of society usually are. It was panelled in dark wood. Partitions of the same wood divided off the room into boxes, so that customers were able to enjoy being in a little wooden world all of their own. The bare floor was kept pleasant with fresh sawdust every day. White cloths covered the tables, and oil lamps were kept clean and their wicks trimmed. Stephen sat down in one of the boxes and ordered a glass of port, which he then proceeded to stare at gloomily. Whenever one of the Pipo Day boys passed Stephen's box, they would stop for a word with Stephen, and he would raise a hand to them in half-hearted salutation. But tonight, he did not trouble himself to answer them. This had happened, oh, two or three times, when suddenly Stephen heard someone say in a vivid whisper,
"You are quite right to pay them no attention, for when all is said and done, what are they but servants and drudges? And when, with my assistance, you are elevated to your rightful place at the very pinnacle of nobility and greatness, it will be a great comfort to you to remember that you spurned their friendship."
It was only a whisper, yet Stephen heard it most distinctly above the voices and laughter of the Pipo Days and other gentlemen. He had the odd idea that, though only a whisper, it could have passed through stone or iron or brass. It could have spoken to you from 1,000 feet beneath the earth, and you would still have heard it. It could have shattered precious stones and brought on madness. This was so very extraordinary that for a moment he was roused from his lethargy. A lively curiosity to discover who had spoken took hold of him, and he looked around the room, but saw no one he did not know. So he stuck his head around the partition and looked into the next box. It contained one person of very striking appearance. He appeared very much at his ease. His arms were resting on the tops of the partition, and his booted feet were resting on the table. He had several remarkable features, but the chief among them was a mass of silvery hair, as bright and soft and shining as thistledown. He winked at Stephen. Then he rose from his own box and came and sat in Stephen's.
"I may as well tell you," he said, speaking in a highly confidential manner, "that this city has not the 100th part of its former splendor. I've been gravely disappointed since my return. Once upon a time, to look upon London was to look upon a forest of towers and pinnacles and spires. The many-colored flags and banners that flew from each and every one dazzled the eye. Upon every side one saw stone carvings as delicate as finger bones and as intricate as flowing water. There were houses ornamented with stone dragons, griffins, and lions, symbolizing the wisdom, courage, and ferocity of the occupants. While in the gardens of those same houses might be found flesh-and-blood dragons, griffins, and lions locked in strong cages. Their roars, which could be clearly heard in the street, terrified the faint of heart. In every church a blessed saint lay performing miracles hourly at the behest of the populace. Each saint was confined within an ivory casket, which was secreted in a jewel-studded coffin, which, in turn, was displayed in a magnificent shrine of gold and silver that shone night and day with the light of 1,000 wax candles. Every day there was a splendid procession to celebrate one or other of these blessed saints, and London's fame passed from world to world. Of course, in those days, the citizens of London were wont to come to me for advice about the construction of their churches, the arrangement of their gardens, the decoration of their houses. If they were properly respectful in their petitions, I would, generally, give them good counsel. Oh, yes. When London owed its appearance to me, it was beautiful, noble, peerless.
But now... He made an eloquent gesture, as if he had crumpled London into a ball in his hand and thrown it away.
But how stupid you look when you stare at me so. I have put myself to any amount of trouble to pay you this visit, and you sit there, silent and sullen, with your mouth hanging open. You are surprised to see me, I dare say, but that is no reason to forget all your good manners.
Of course, he remarked, in the manner of someone making a great concession.
Englishmen are often all amazement in my presence. That is the most natural thing in the world. But you and I are such friends that I think I have deserved a better welcome than this.
Have we met before, sir? Asked Stephen in astonishment. I have certainly dreamt of you. I dreamt that you and I were together in an immense mansion with endless dusty corridors.
Have we met before, sir?
Mocked the gentleman with the thistledown hair.
Why, what nonsense you talk, as if we had not attended the same feasts and balls and parties every night for weeks and weeks.
Certainly in my dreams.
I had not thought you could be so dull-witted,
cried the gentleman.
Lost hope is not a dream. It is the oldest and most beautiful of my mansions, which are numerous. And it's quite as real as Carlton House.
Footnote 1. The London home of the Prince of Wales, in Pall Mall.
In fact, it is a great deal more so. Much of the future is known to me, and I tell you that Carlton House will be levelled to the ground in 20 years' time, and the city of London itself will endure, scarcely another 2,000 years, whereas lost hope will stand until the next age of the world.
He looked ridiculously pleased with this thought, and indeed it must be said that his natural manner seemed to be one of extreme self-congratulation.
No, it is no dream. You are merely under an enchantment which brings you each night the lost hope to join our fairy revels.
Stephen stared at the gentleman uncomprehendingly. Then, remembering that he must speak or lay himself open to accusations of sullenness and bad manners, he gathered his wits and stammered out, And
is the enchantment yours, sir?
But of course.
It was clear from the pleased air with which he spoke that the gentleman with the thistledown hair considered that he had bestowed the greatest of favours upon Stephen by enchanting him. Stephen thanked him politely for it.
Although, he added, I cannot imagine what I have done to deserve such kindness from you. Indeed, I am sure I have done nothing at all.
Ah, cried the gentleman, delighted. Yours are excellent manners, Stephen Black. You could teach the proud English a thing or two about the proper respect that is due to persons of quality. Your manners will bring you good luck in the end.
And those golden guineas in Mrs. Brandis' cashbox, said Stephen, were they yours too?
Oh, have you only just guessed it? But only observe how clever I have been. Remembering all that you told me about how you are surrounded night and day by enemies who wish you harm, I conveyed the money to a friend of yours. Then, when you and she marry, the money will be yours.
How did... began Stephen, and stopped.
Clearly there was no part of his life that the gentleman did not know about, and nothing with which the gentleman did not feel entitled to interfere.
But you are mistaken about my enemies, sir, he said.
I do not have any. My dear Stephen, cried the gentleman, greatly amused. Of course you have enemies, and the chief among them is that wicked man who is your master and Lady Pole's husband. He forces you to be his servant and do his bidding night and day. He sets tasks before you that are entirely unsuited to a person of your beauty and nobility. And why does he do these things?
I suppose because, began Stephen.
Precisely, declared the gentleman triumphantly. Because in the fulsomeness of his wickedness, he has captured you and girded you with chains, and now he triumphs over you, dancing about and howling with wicked laughter to see you in such straits.
Stephen opened his mouth to protest that Sir Walter Pole had never done any of those things, that he had always treated Stephen with great kindness and affection, that when Sir Walter was younger, he had paid money he could ill afford so that Stephen could go to school, and that later, when Sir Walter was poorer still, they had often eaten the same food and shared the same fire. As for triumphing over his enemies, Stephen had often seen Sir Walter wear a very self-satisfied smirk when he believed he had scored a point against his political opponents, but he had never seen him dance about or howl with wicked laughter. Stephen was about to say these things when the mention of the word chains seemed to send a sort of silent thunderbolt through him. Suddenly, in his fancy, he saw a dark place, a terrible place, a place full of horror, a hot, rank, closed-in place. There were shadows in the darkness, and the slither and clank of heavy iron chains. What this image meant, or where it had come from, he had not the least idea. He did not think it could be a memory. Surely he had never been in such a place.
If ever he were to discover that every night you and she escaped from him to be happy in my house, why, he would be thrown instantly into fits of jealousy, and would, I dare say, try to kill you both. But fear not, my dear, dear Stephen. I will take good care he never finds out. Oh, I detest such selfish people. I know what it is to be scorned and slighted by the proud English, and put to perform tasks that are beneath one's dignity. I cannot bear to see the same fate befall you.
The gentleman paused to caress Stephen's cheek and brow with his icy white fingers, which produced a queer tingling sensation in Stephen's skin.
You cannot conceive what a warm interest I feel in you, and how anxious I am to do you some lasting service, which is why I have conceived a plan to make you the king of some fairy kingdom.
I beg your pardon, sir. I was thinking of something else. A king, you say? No, sir, I could not be a king. It is only your great kindness to me that makes you think it possible. Besides, I am very much afraid that Fairyland does not quite agree with me. Ever since I first visited your house, I have been stupid and heavy. I'm tired morning, noon, and night, and my life is a burden to me. I dare say the fault is all mine, but perhaps mortals are not formed for fairy bliss.
Oh, that is simply the sadness you feel at the dreariness of England compared to the delightful life you lead at my house, where there is always dancing and feasting, and everyone is dressed in their finest clothes.
I dare say you are right, sir. Yet if you were to find it in your heart to release me from this enchantment, I should be very grateful to you.
Oh, but that is impossible, declared the gentleman. Do you not know that my beautiful sisters and cousins, for each of whom I may say kings have killed each other and great empires fallen into decay, all quarrel over who will be your next dancing partner? And what would they say if I told them you would come to Lost Hope no more? For among my many other virtues, I am a most attentive brother and cousin, and always try to please the females of my household when I can. And as for declining to become a king, there is nothing, I assure you, more agreeable than having everyone bow before one and call one by all sorts of noble titles.
He resumed his extravagant praises of Stephen's beauty, dignified countenance, and elegant dancing, all of which he seemed to consider the chief qualifications for the ruler of a vast kingdom in Faerie, and he began to speculate upon which kingdom would suit Stephen best.
Untold blessings is a fine place, with dark impenetrable forests, lonely mountains, and uncrossable seas. It has the advantage of being without a ruler at present, but then it has the disadvantage that there are 26 other claimants already, and you would be plunged straight away into the middle of a bloody civil war, which perhaps you would not care for. And then there is the dukedom of Pity Me. The present duke has no friends to speak of. Oh, but I could not bear to see any friend of mine ruler of such a miserable little place as Pity Me.
Chapter 20. The Unlikely Milliner. February 1808. Those people who had expected the war to be over, now that the magician had appeared upon the scene, were soon disappointed.
Magic, said Mr. Canning, the Foreign Secretary. Do not speak to me of magic. It's just like everything else, full of setbacks and disappointments.
There was some justice in this, and Mr. Norrell was always happy to give long, difficult explanations of why something was not possible. Once, in making one of these explanations, he said something which he later regretted. It was at Burlington House, and Mr. Norrell was explaining to Lord Hawkesbury, the Home Secretary, Footnote 1. A Robert Banks Jenkinson, Lord Hawkesbury, 1770 to 1828. On the death of his father in December 1808, he became the Earl of Liverpool. For the next 9 years, he would prove to be one of Mr. Norrell's most steady supporters. That something or other could not be attempted, since it would take, at least a dozen magicians working day and night. He made a long, tedious speech about the pitiful state of English magic, ending,
"I would it were otherwise, but as your lordship is aware, our talented young men look to the army, the navy, and the church for their careers. My own poor profession is sadly neglected."
And he gave a great sigh. Mr. Norrell meant nothing much by this, except perhaps to draw attention to his own extraordinary talent. But unfortunately, Lord Hawkesbury took up quite another idea.
"Oh," he cried, "you mean we need more magicians? Oh, yes, I quite see that. Quite, a school, perhaps, or a royal society under His Majesty's patronage. Well, Mr. Norrell, I really think we will leave the details to you. If you'll be so good as to draw up a memorandum upon the subject, I shall be glad to read it and submit its proposals to the other ministers. We all know your skill at drawing up such things, so clear and so detailed, and your handwriting so good. I dare say, sir, we shall find you a little money from somewhere. When you have time, sir, there is no hurry. I know how busy you are."
Poor Mr. Norrell. Nothing could be less to his taste than the creation of other magicians. He comforted himself with the thought that Lord Hawkesbury was an exemplary minister, devoted to business with 1,001 things to think about. Doubtless, he would soon forget all about it. But the very next time that Mr. Norrell was at Burlington House, Lord Hawkesbury came hurrying up to him, crying out,
"Ah, Mr. Norrell, I've spoken to the King about your plan for making new magicians. His Majesty was very pleased, thought the idea an excellent one, and asked me to tell you that he would be glad to extend his patronage to the scheme."
It was fortunate that before Mr. Norrell could reply, the sudden arrival of the Swedish ambassador in the room obliged his lordship to hurry away again. But a week or so later, Mr. Norrell met Lord Hawkesbury again, this time at a special dinner given by the Prince of Wales in honour of Mr. Norrell at Carlton House.
"Ah, Mr. Norrell, there you are. I don't suppose that you have the recommendations for the magician school about you, only I've just been speaking to the Duke of Devonshire, and he's most interested. Thinks he has a house in Leamington Spa, which would be just the thing, and has asked me questions about the curriculum, and whether there would be prayers, and where the magicians would sleep, all sorts of things I have not the least idea about. I wonder, would you be so kind as to speak to him? He is just over there by the mantelpiece. Oh, he's seen us. He's coming this way. Your Grace, here is Mr. Norrell, ready to tell you all about it."
It was with some difficulty that Mr. Norrell was able to convince Lord Hawkesbury and the Duke of Devonshire that a school would take up far too much time, and moreover, he had yet to see any young men with sufficient talent to make the attempt worthwhile. Reluctantly, His Grace and His Lordship were obliged to agree, and Mr. Norrell was able to turn his attention to a far more agreeable project, that of destroying the magicians already in existence. The street sorcerers of the City of London had long constituted a standing irritation of his spirits. While he was still unknown and unregarded, he had begun to petition members of the government and other eminent gentlemen for the removal of these vagabond magicians. Naturally, the moment that he attained public eminence, he doubled and tripled his efforts. His first idea was that magic ought to be regulated by the government, and magicians ought to be licensed, though naturally he had no idea of anyone being licensed but himself. He proposed that a proper regulatory board of magic be established, but in this he was too ambitious. As Lord Hawkesbury said to Sir Walter,
"We have no wish to offend a man who has done the country such service, but in the middle of a long and difficult war, to demand that a board be set up with privy councillors and secretaries and Lord knows what else. And for what? To listen to Mr. Norrell talk and to pay Mr. Norrell compliments? Well, that's quite out of the question. My dear Sir Walter, persuade him to some other course, I beg you."
So the next time that Sir Walter and Mr. Norrell met, which was at Mr. Norrell's house in Hanover Square, Sir Walter addressed his friend with the following words.
"It is an admirable purpose, sir, and no one quarrels with it. But a board is precisely the wrong way of going about it. Within the City of London, which is where the problem chiefly lies, the board would have no authority. I tell you what we shall do. Tomorrow you and I shall go to the Mansion House,
to wait upon the Lord Mayor and one or two of the aldermen. I think we shall soon find some friends for our cause.
But my dear Sir Walter, cried Mr. Norrell, it will not do. The problem is not confined to London. I've looked into it since I left Yorkshire.
Here he delved into a pile of papers upon a little table at his elbow to fetch out a list.
And there are 12 street sorcerers in Norwich, 2 in Yarmouth, 2 in Gloucester, 6 in Winchester, 42 in Penzance. Why, only the other day, one, a dirty female, came to my house and would not be satisfied without seeing me, whereupon she demanded that I give her a paper, a certificate of competence, no less, testifying to my belief that she could do magic. I was never more astonished in my life. I said to her, Woman,
as to the other places that you mention, said Sir Walter, interrupting hastily, I think you'll find that once London rids itself of this nuisance, then the others will be quick to follow. They none of them like to feel themselves left behind.
Mr. Norrell soon found that it was just as Sir Walter had predicted. The Lord Mayor and the Aldermen were eager to be part of the glorious revival of English magic. They persuaded the Court of Common Council to set up a committee for magical acts, and the committee decreed that only Mr. Norrell was permitted to do magic within the city boundaries, and that other persons who set up booths or shops or otherwise molested the citizens of London with claims to do magic were to be expelled forthwith. The street sorcerers packed up their little stalls, loaded their shabby possessions into handcarts, and trudged out of the city. Some took the trouble to curse London as they left, but by and large they bore the change in their fortunes with admirable philosophy. Most had simply settled it in their own minds that henceforth they would give up magic and become instead beggars and thieves, and since they had indulged in beggary and thievery in an amateur way for years, the wrench was not so great as you might imagine. But one did not go. Vinculus, the magician of Threadneedle Street, stayed in his booth and continued to foretell unhappy futures and to sell petty revenges to slighted lovers and resentful apprentices. Naturally, Mr. Norrell complained very vigorously to the Committee for Magical Acts about this state of affairs, since Vinculus was the sorcerer whom he hated most. The Committee for Magical Acts dispatched beadles and constables to threaten Vinculus with the stocks, but Vinculus paid them no attention, and he was so popular among London's citizens that the committee feared a riot if he was removed by force. On a bleak February day, Vinculus was in his magician's booth beside the church of St. Christopher le Stocks. In case there are any readers who do not remember the magician's booths of our childhood, it ought to be stated that in shape the booth rather resembled a Punch and Judy theatre or a shopkeeper's stall at a fair, and that it was built of wood and canvas. A yellow curtain, ornamented to half its height with a thick crust of dirt, served both as a door and as a sign to advertise the services that were offered within. On this particular day, Vinculus had no customers and very little hope of getting any. The city streets were practically deserted. A bitter grey fog that tasted of smoke and tar hung over London. The city shopkeepers had heaped coals upon their fires and lit every lamp they possessed in a vain attempt to dispel the dark and the cold. But today, their bow windows cast no cheerful glow into the streets. The light could not penetrate the fog. Consequently, no one was enticed into the shops to spend money, and the shopmen, in their long white aprons and powdered wigs, stood about at their ease, chatting to each other or warming themselves at the fire. It was a day when anyone with something to do indoors stayed indoors to do it, and anyone who was obliged to go outside did so quickly and got back inside again as soon as he could. Vinculus sat gloomily behind his curtain, half frozen to death, turning over in his mind the names of the 2 or 3 alehouse keepers who might be persuaded to sell him a glass or two of hot spiced wine on credit. He had almost made up his mind which of them to try first, when the sounds of someone stamping their feet and blowing upon their fingers seemed to suggest that a customer stood without. Vinculus raised the curtain and stepped outside.
Are you the magician?
Vinculus agreed, a little suspiciously, that he was. The man had the air of a bailiff.
Excellent. I have a commission for you.
It is 2 shillings for the first consultation.
The man put his hand in his pocket, pulled out his purse, and put 2 shillings into Vinculus's hand. Then he began to describe the problem that he wished Vinculus to magic away. His explanation was very clear, and he knew exactly what it was that he wished Vinculus to do. The only problem was that the more the man talked, the less Vinculus believed him. The man said that he had come from Windsor. That was perfectly possible. True, he spoke with a northern accent, but there was nothing odd in that. People often came down from the northern counties to make their fortunes. The man also said he was the owner of a successful millinery business. Now that seemed a good deal less likely. For anyone less like a milliner, it was difficult to imagine. Vinculus knew little enough about milliners, but he did know that they generally dress in the very height of fashion. This fellow wore an ancient black coat that had been patched and mended a dozen times. His linen, though clean and of good quality, would have been old-fashioned 20 years ago. Vinculus did not know the names of the 101 little fancy articles that milliners make, but he knew that milliners know them. This man did not. He called them folderols. In the freezing weather, the ground had become an unhappy compound of ice and frozen mud, and as Vinculus was writing down the particulars in a greasy little book, he somehow missed his footing and fell against the unlikely milliner. He tried to stand, but so treacherous was the icy ground that he was obliged to use the other man as a sort of ladder to climb up. The unlikely milliner looked rather appalled to have strong fumes of ale and cabbage breathed in his face, and bony fingers grabbing him all over, but he said nothing.
"Beg pardon,"
muttered Vinculus, but at last he was in an upright position again.
"Granted," said the unlikely milliner, politely brushing from his coat the stale crumbs, gobbets of matted grease and dirt, and other little signs of Vinculus having been there.
Vinculus, too, was adjusting his clothes, which had got somewhat disarranged in his tumble. The unlikely milliner continued with his tale.
"So, as I say, my business thrives, and my bonnets are the most sought after in all of Windsor, and scarcely a week goes by but one of the princesses up at the castle comes to order a new bonnet or folderol. I've put a great golden plaster image of the royal arms above my door to advertise the royal patronage I enjoy. Yet still I cannot help but think that millinery is a great deal of work, sitting up late at night sewing bonnets, counting my money and so forth. It seems to me that my life might be a great deal easier if one of the princesses were to fall in love with me and marry me. Do you have such a spell, magician?"
"A love spell? Oh, certainly. But it will be expensive. I generally charge 4 shillings for a spell to catch a milkmaid, 10 shillings for a seamstress, and 6 guineas for a widow with her own business." "A princess,
Vinculus scratched his unshaven cheek with his dirty fingernails.
40 guineas?
He hazarded.
"Very well."
"And which is it?" asked Vinculus.
"Which what is what?"
asked the unlikely milliner.
"Which princess?"
"Well, they're all pretty much the same, aren't they? Does the price vary with the princess?"
"No, not really. I'll give you the spell written upon a piece of paper. Tear the paper in two and sew half inside the breast of your coat. You need to place the other half in a secret place inside the garments of whichever princess you decide upon."
The unlikely milliner looked astonished.
"And how in the world can I do that?"
Vinculus looked at the man.
"I thought you just said that you sewed their bonnets."
The unlikely milliner laughed.
"Oh, yes, of course."
Vinculus stared at the man suspiciously.
"You're no more a milliner than I'm a
magician?" suggested the unlikely milliner. "You must certainly admit that it's not your only profession. After all, you just picked my pockets."
"Only because I wish to know what sort of villain you are,"
retorted Vinculus, and he shook his arm until the articles he had taken from the pockets of the unlikely milliner fell out of his sleeve. There were a handful of silver coins, 2 golden guineas, and 3 or 4 folded sheets of paper. He picked up the papers. The sheets were small and thick and of excellent quality. They were all covered in close lines of small, neat handwriting. At the top of the first sheet was written, 2 spells to make an obstinate man leave London, and 1 spell to discover what my enemy is doing presently."
"The magician of Hanover Square," declared Vinculus.
Childermas, for it was he, nodded. Vinculus read through the spells. The first was intended to make the subject believe that every London churchyard was haunted by the people who were buried there, and that every bridge was haunted by the suicides who had thrown themselves from it. The subject would see the ghosts as they had appeared at their deaths, with all the marks of violence, disease, and extreme old age upon them. In this way, he would become more and more terrified until he dared not pass either a bridge or a church, which in London is a serious inconvenience, as the bridges are not more than 100 yards apart and the churches considerably less. The second spell was intended to persuade the subject that he would find his one true love and all sorts of happiness in the country, and the third spell, the one to discover what your enemy was doing, involved a mirror, and had presumably been intended by Norrell to enable Childermas to spy upon Vinculus.
Vinculus sneered. You may tell the Mayfair magician that his spells have no effect upon me.
Indeed, said Childermas sarcastically.
Well, that is probably because I have not cast them.
Vinculus flung the papers down upon the ground.
Cast them now!
He folded his arms in an attitude of defiance and made his eyes flash, as he did whenever he conjured the spirit of the River Thames.
Thank you, but no. And why not?
Because, like you, I do not care to be told how to conduct my business. My master has ordered me to make sure that you leave London, but I intend to do it in my way, not his. Come, I think it'll be best if you and I have a talk, Vinculus.
Vinculus thought about this.
And could this talk take place somewhere warmer? An alehouse, perhaps?
Certainly, if you wish.
The papers with Norrell's spells upon them were blowing about their feet. Vinculus stooped down, gathered them together, and paying no regard to the bits of straw and mud sticking to them, put them in the breast of his coat.